Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. On today's episode, episode number 119, entitled Biohacking Your Health with Smart Drugs, Nootropics, and Supplements, I chat with the first ever two-time returning Elite Man podcast guest, biohacking pioneer, scientist, and chemist, Steve Fowkes. Steve joins us today to share with us his best tips for biohacking your health and getting into the best shape of your life. He dives into a gambit of fascinating topics in this episode, including biohacking through supplementation, intermittent fasting, balancing your pH scale, ozone therapy, and so much more. If you're wondering how you can biohack your health and optimize the latest research and technology to improve your well-being, this episode is for you. You are going to love it. Gentlemen, have you joined the best Facebook group on the planet yet? If not, check your pulse right now because there is something seriously wrong with you. I say this all the time, guys, but seriously, the Elite Man Mastermind group on Facebook is the number one community for connecting with men, connecting with great men. We've had thousands of guys now join the group and share ideas every single day on becoming the elite and best men we can be. So join the group right now by going to elitemanmastermind.com. If for some reason you haven't joined yet and request to join the group, it is a private group, which means you do have to request, but I will add you in within just a few hours after your request. Trust me, you are going to love this group and absolutely love being a part of the Elite Man Mastermind. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from EliteManMagazine.com, and my guest today is a repeat guest, Steve Fowkes from Project Wellbeing. Steve, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me back. Come up with some good questions.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. We had so much fun doing the first one and so many unanswered questions from the last episode we had you on. I knew I had to bring you back on and kind of pick your brain even further because, you know, like I mentioned in the last episode, you're just one of those guys that everybody turns to for all the answers when it comes to biohacking, when it comes to Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, supplements, all that stuff. So I'm really just excited to get you back on and you know, pick your brain again, man.
Fire away.
So, Steve, let's start first with what are some of just like general supplements you recommend for guys to take? I mean, our audience is primarily men, 25 to 35, maybe 25 to 40. What are some everyday supplements you recommend they take just to kind of stay on top of their game and, performing their best?
Well, some of it has to do with their level of sexual activity. So, for example, every time a man ejaculates, he loses zinc and selenium, which are two very important antioxidants that protect semen, or in the semen, to protect the sperm from aging effects and environmental exposure. And so if a man is highly sexually active, he may need to take zinc and selenium supplements.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else?
Well, that's just an example of something that is very sex stratified. In general, women don't have that same kind of nutritional requirement. So that's something that's very specific for men. But depending upon the degree of one's, you know, functionality and what one wants to do, it matters whether or not you're using a shovel as a tool for earning a living or using your brain as a tool for earning a living. If you're working out or you're not working out, if you're operating in a challenging environment, let's say you're a police officer or you're a fireman or you're an emergency medical technician, then that's going to be different than, let's say, you're a computer programmer where, on the whole, if you have a moment where you pause and take a nap, it doesn't really hurt your career. If you're doing contract work, it doesn't matter whether or not you work around the clock or whether or not you work at a particular time, it's measured by your overall productivity instead of a predictable functionality. So each one of those examples would be different. If you're an athlete, for example, you'd have different kinds of requirements than if you're a computer programmer.
I forgot to sort of ask you this in the last episode we did, but you're a big tester of all sorts of things, whether that's smart drugs, whether that's supplements, whether it's vitamins, minerals, etc. But if you're testing things like, you know, that aren't natural, for instance, like something you'd get in your food, like a mineral or a vitamin, are there such things as like free lunches? I know like Tim Ferriss talks about this a lot. There's no such thing as a free lunch in nature. Can you get away with taking things like smart drugs without having like a backlash to you, like a side effect that comes along with that?
Well, I think Ferriss is right on a philosophical level, and biology is all about compromise. There's, you know, biological systems never deal with optimization because it's too expensive. And so the question is, what can you do with what resources you can get, that you can get reasonably? So for example, in vitamin C, you got to climb a tree to pick a piece of fruit. There's a certain danger that you might fall out of the tree. That makes vitamin C expensive. The fact that you have to find the tree, you have to identify the sources of the fruit, that's, you know, there's a certain amount of investment that goes into that. Well, nowadays you can buy a gram of vitamin C for 2 cents. So where's the cost in that? You know, it's a totally different equation. And therefore, the set point where nature picks this, how much vitamin C per unit of investment, is now totally different in our modern environment. And it's now shifted by, you know, two orders of magnitude. And so, you know, that's one of the things that I tell people is that in this day and age, if you're not taking 2 to 4 grams of vitamin C a day, you're really missing out on one of the least expensive, most health-producing things that you can do as a self-care technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Linus Pauling. I'm actually taking right now 4 to 5 grams a day, and this kind of started after I had pneumonia four or five months back now. Horrible, obviously, you know, it's something, it really sucks when you have it, but after that I just kind of got on this regimen of taking 4 to 5 a day of that, and then, you know, I just generally take a B complex, a fish oil, and a vitamin D, especially in the winter time / like fall up in New England where I'm from, we get less of that, so I take a supplement, probably 2 to 4 thousand IUs of that a day. You know, yeah. And that's kind of it, though. I won't really. And then also, I'll take occasionally turmeric because I get headaches periodically. And it's, I know it's just good for inflammation, generally speaking. But that's it. I don't try to take too many different things. I just kind of take what I felt has worked for me best over the years. And I also mentioned to you I was getting tendonitis years ago. And so I got on this kind of protocol of taking fish oil, and that's helped. And also the turmeric as well. If I start to get like a little thing of, you know, tendonitis creeping up, the turmeric will knock it right out. I feel, you know, it works for me. Do you kind of recommend that approach where you just kind of take maybe a couple things where it works for you? Or are you kind of, you know, I know you're a big experimenter. Are you more about taking, you know, a lot of things at once and, you know, kind of living that way?
Well, I take a handful twice a day. But what I recognize is that that's a different issue for each person. So there are people who think about health as the absence of taking medications. And so when you're sick, you take pills, and when you get well, you stop taking pills. And that's the mental equation. And so for them, taking vitamins all the time is a kind of psychological stressor because they equate that with being sick. And so they're not going to be comfortable taking a lot of pills, and just getting them to take vitamin C and a B-complex vitamin or a multivitamin is generally as far as you can go without some major life-changing experience to motivate them, to reorient them in some way. But on the whole, if you don't have a way of guiding it, I'd say most people take supplements based on faith. It's a kind of religion, and it's all based on their perception of benefit, their mental attachment to reading something about something and going, oh, that sounds like me, therefore I should take that. And they take it without really solid evidence that it's doing something good for them. That's why I like the self-care model and the biohacking model, is because you can actually collect evidence from your body that taking something is doing you good, or that it's not doing you good. In other words, its effect is either neutral or you know, nothing. And so that's why I like this idea of biohacking, is that it gives you a way of judging, does taking 4 grams of vitamin C a day give you something good for yourself? Does taking CoQ10 give you something good? Does taking niacin give you something good? If you're able to investigate each one of those things and learn from your own body whether or not your body wants it or not, you now have a basis for taking it that isn't just faith-based.
Yeah. I agree, man. That's a kind of a great way to put it. I've taken a number of things too. I've taken resveratrol, CoQ10, turmeric, which I still take now. I mean, I've taken a number of different things, ashwagandha, just different things over the years and tried them. And for me, a lot of those things haven't stuck. The only thing that I really think has stuck is the turmeric as far as herbs go. But they haven't worked for me, or I haven't noticed any, you know, significant benefits. Or maybe, you know, it was just the brand or the quality I was getting. But I'm not going to sit here and you know, put those supplements down or say they don't work or they're not great for other people.
Don't know that they're good for you.
Exactly. Just because they didn't work for me or they weren't you know, noticeably better for me doesn't mean that they're not super effective for other people. So I really like the way you put that. And you know, I'm a big proponent of being proactive with your health and being proactive with taking things. And kind of like you, like I mentioned before too, I'm not as crazy as you are, or maybe as bold as you are with trying different things. But I have tried a lot, and I will experiment to an extent with taking stuff. You know, what are some of the smart drugs you've taken? Because I mean, I'm
well,
totally.
Let me give you a story about paracetam, because it's a good illustration. Because you know, it goes to that question of getting a benefit from something, but it also goes to that question of not noticing things. Mm-hmm. I started taking paracetam back in the early 90s, and I had read all about it for quite a bit of time, and finally I decided to import some of it, and I talked a doctor into prescribing it, and I bought a kilo through a compounding pharmacy. And so I, you know, it was like, okay, let's check this out. Let's do this for real instead of just playing with it. So I started taking paracetam, and I noticed a lot of stuff. One was that the bitter flavor of paracetam dissolved in water without capsules. I took it in powdered form. That bitter flavor that initially was aversive became attractive. And I started craving the bitter flavor. In other words, like a sweet tooth, but it was a bitter tooth, which was, I think, coming from my subconscious mind that was telling me, this is good stuff. And my conscious mind noticed I was a better writer. I was a better speaker. I was was better at presentation, at visualization. I've been doing graphics and stuff like that. I was better at all of those kinds of things, mainly in language skills, though. And, you know, it's not my area of expertise, writing and speaking. That's not my talent, let me put it that way. But so I knew that this was good stuff, and that I liked it, and I was going to be using it, and it's become one of my two favorite smart drugs of choice. But what I didn't notice was that I became multitasking. But my wife noticed, and all three of my coworkers noticed. Every one of them noticed, and I didn't. So this is one of those things that can be awkward when you deal with something like paracetam, which its effects are almost transparent. It's not like caffeine, where you feel different and you can tell when you've consumed caffeine and when you haven't. Paracetam isn't like that. It's so transparent that many people think it's not having any effect at all. So I became interruptible. They could come up to me when I'm writing something and I've just moved a paragraph and I've got these segue problems that I have to work with. They could come up to me, interrupt me, ask me a question about something that's on their agenda. I could answer the question, go right back to writing, and keep in my head where those segue problems were.
Wow.
I couldn't do that without piracetam.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. But the point is, even that, though that's on some level blatant, I didn't notice it. So this is why, you know, you can't say too much that objective measurements is a great idea.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. I wonder if, you know, taking the CoQ10, I was like that and I didn't notice it.
Well, yeah, but the point is that for issues of mental performance, for something to be obvious, you've got to test yourself against a computer or against another person or against some inanimate object, because our consciousness flows and ebbs, you know, so much during the course of a day that we really don't have a good benchmark for judging minute to minute changes. But if you're doing Lumosity or you're doing Quantified Mind and you're playing games where you're measuring simple and complex decision making or even just reaction time stuff, you get to see those kinds of differences. And that can give you feedback. But that's a bit of a challenge for a lot of people to go log on online and every day play a set of games. But physical strength, stamina, speed, those are body, performance issues under exercise, where if you have any kind of exercise program, you know how many reps you can do, you know how much weight you can lift, you know how long it takes you to bicycle around this route or walk this route. And if you just time yourself and, you know, look at the number of reps and feel how tired are you after doing 10 reps or 12 reps or whatever it is that's your program, you can learn a lot about what's going on at an energy production level just through your muscles.
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense, man. Like if you take, you know, creatine or protein or something like that and you go to the gym, you can tell within like a couple of weeks if your weights are going up, if your strength is better than it was before, or if there's no, you know, noticeable benefit. And I think it's the same thing, you know, mentally taking something like that or, you know, playing a game. I think, you know, chess even came to mind, something like that, where you can visibly see if you're thinking, you know, focusing better, thinking better, making the better moves, maybe reacting quicker, all those things. What are some of the smart drugs you're taking now or you have been taking for a while besides paracetam?
Well, there's only two that I take all the time or regularly, and that's paracetam and Deprenil. But, you know, the benefits of looking at something that's physiological is that your body can tell you that this is a good thing in a matter of hours or maybe even 2 or 3 days. If you take carnitine and it improves your fat metabolism, you'll see a change in your exercise performance the next time you go into the gym.
Wow.
It's that fast. It's true that, you know, stamina, the building up of stamina in terms of challenging your creatine phosphate reserves and your glycogen reserves and stuff like that, that's definitely a longer thing. If you're running marathons and you're going to take down your glycogen and you're going to flip into fat burning mode, you have to study that over a longer term. And certainly tendon strength and ligament strength is a very slow thing to develop. But in terms of cellular energy production, looking at Krebs cycle, looking at glucose burning and fat burning, you can tell that in hours. I've seen examples where people are going into ketosis and they're performing at a particular level. And then when ketosis kicks in, you know, 10 minutes later, they're performing 50% higher level and wow, they don't even notice it because their mind has sped up. Their muscles have sped up, and so everything looks and feels the same to them, but they're walking 50% faster, or they're exercising more, you know, in some way. I mean, the walking is the easiest thing to see because it's so rhythmic that people become hypnotized by the rhythm, and they can't tell when they speed up.
That's incredible, man. Are there any supplements you take? Like, do you take carnitine? Do you take any vitamins, minerals regularly?
Yes, I take a lot regularly. My carnitine, I don't take carnitine. I've taken it. It doesn't seem to have any significant effect, so I don't bother with it. I take most of my B-complex vitamins and stuff as a general preventive, prophylactically. Again, I don't see much benefit to them. So, you know, the things that I notice are, for example, dopaminergic tone. If I don't take any Deprenyl, I become unacceptably apathetic and passive towards life. And that's just, it's just, to me, a complete waste of life, I guess would be the right way to say it. You know, there's just so much to be passionate about that, you know, living passionately is like a requirement. It's like breathing. It's just something that I want to cultivate that.
Can you get these drugs online, like on Amazon or anything, or are they something that need to be prescribed?
Well, if you're getting it from inside the United States border, it has to be prescribed. There are you can certainly approach your doctor and ask that kind of question. For something like Deprenyl, I think unless you're dealing with an anti-aging doctor, you're likely to get a "why would you want to do that?" answer, you know, and "no, I won't prescribe it for you." But if that's the case, you can always get it from outside the United States through the FDA's personal use importation policy. There are plenty of pharmacies around the world. You have to be somewhat cautious because there's a lot of drug counterfeiting out there, especially in China and other third world countries. Even though China may not be a third world country anymore, it's kind of the wild, wild west in terms of business ethics. But if you're buying from a company like International Anti-Aging Systems out of the UK, you're buying European brands of drugs like Jumex brand Deprenyl, and it's as reliable a product as you get in the United States, made by an international drug company to exactly the same kinds of standards that are used in the United States.
Cool. Are you ever worried about, like, you know, these drugs getting banned, or maybe, you know, just kind of something happening where they get, like, regulated and they're not available anymore? Does that ever, like, cross your mind? Like, because, like you mentioned, when you don't take Deprenyl, you're, like, apathetic and, you know, basically just feel like, the world doesn't matter or anything like that. So does that ever kind of cross your mind?
Well, yeah, but and I have a backup supply that I keep for that exact reason. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the worst case scenario is you go to a foreign country, you see a doctor there, you get a prescription for it, and you bring it back into the country. So all that does is raise the price. But fundamentally, there's so much stuff coming into the United States in this day and age that maybe 1 in 100 packages gets inspected and stopped. So if you have a shipment, I mean, right now it wouldn't be unthinkable to have a shipment of pharmaceuticals be seized by customs. It's just that there's no way they can monitor the flow of packages to shut it down. It's just not an affordable activity on the part of the government. They like to think that they keep the border tight, but in reality, it's like a sieve. You know, they're inspecting 1% of packages coming through by hand. And if you see some capsules going through, it's not metal, it's not hard, it's not like, you know, some kind of equipment or, you know, some kind of munition or something like that. They really don't care that much about that kind of stuff. And, you know, in my entire life of bringing stuff in, I've never had a package seized yet. Other people that I know who bring stuff in do have a history, do have some history of running into that kind of thing, but it's the occasional package here and there. And at most, it might be 10%. And I would think 1 in 20 to 1 in 40 packages get intercepted.
What is the penalty, I mean, for those people that did get caught? It's not like smuggling heroin or anything, is it?
No. No. Bringing a drug in is at most a misdemeanor, and unless you're a teacher or a police officer or a government employee with a security clearance, people couldn't care less. So it's not an issue. But if you're bringing in narcotics, if you're bringing in steroids, so you're bringing in a Schedule 3 or Schedule 2 or Schedule 1 substance, that's an entirely different matter. But these things that we're talking about here aren't even scheduled.
Steve, there's so many different supplement companies out there, so many different smart drug companies out there. I guess just sticking to the supplements, like, what are some of the things you look for in a good supplement company? Or maybe you have a couple of brands that you want to recommend to our guys, because I know that, you know, they can kind of get lost in the shuffle of trying to find a good quality supplement. And, you know, there's just so many to choose from. And then you got like so many that there's always these studies, these crackdowns from consumer labs or other, you know, agencies that like test these vitamins and minerals and different supplements, and the quality of what they say is in it is totally like not there.
Especially worry about ingredients that come from China.
Yeah.
It's not that the Chinese can't make good ingredients. They certainly can. But sometimes they don't. And there are also brokers who will buy things that aren't thoroughly tested. And so you can see this issue where you buy something and the samples turns out to be highly pure, and then what you get delivered isn't so pure. And then after a year of shipments, it's even worse. That kind of thing that happens. So I ask the supplement companies, if it's amino acid, for example, are you getting it from China or are you getting it from Japan? If they're getting it from Japan or Europe, I think it's probably likely good. So I ask those kinds of questions. The other thing I like to ask supplement manufacturers is, do they practice short-run manufacturing? That goes to the question of how old a supplement is when you get it, when you buy it, how long has it been sitting on the shelf? And that's not such an important consideration when you're buying, let's say, carnitine or vitamin C that is a single ingredient. Most chemicals, when they're, you know, dry and well protected, have a very long shelf life. But when you start to do multivitamin formulations and B-complex vitamin formulations particularly, the ingredients tend to interact with each other. And the older the product is, the smellier it is, and the less active nutrition is in that product for you. And short-run manufacturing is at least a guarantee, if they make something three times a year, that when you buy it, it's roughly 4 months of age or less. And if they make it 10 times a year, it's going to be 2 months of age or less. So that's a question I ask. Right now, the FDA is kind of warring against short-run manufacturing by implementing quality standards that require that every batch that's made be individually tested. So if you do one batch for the entire year, you only have to test once. And if you do it 10 times a year, you have to test 10 times. And so if you do short-run manufacturing, you pay 10 times more in terms of product quality assurance testing, which, you know, having been in the vitamin industry and having made my own vitamins in the industry and at home, I think is completely unnecessary. That it's very easy to do quality control through testing incoming materials, where you just guarantee the right mixing formulas and weighing things out to know what's actually in it, rather than having to test each batch every time to verify that, you know, that it's exactly what they say it is. I think that's part of one of the problems of, it's part of one of the problems of why we have a medical system that's the way it is today. The FDA has a certain mentality that lends itself to pharmaceuticals and is actually quite antagonistic to drugs. Excuse me, to nutrients.
Yeah, it almost seems like it's counterproductive when they test the batches that often, right? Because they force manufacturers to not want to make the short runs, right?
That's right. Also, when you test nutrients, you're testing materials that interact with each other in a synergistic way. You know, B1 doesn't operate by itself. It needs B2 and it needs B3. And all the Bs work together on some level. The nutritional minerals work together on some level. And the FDA's mindset is drug oriented, where instead of things working synergistically, what you're testing is working antagonistically. It's obstructing a nutrient path. It's blocking something from happening that's supposed to be happening. Even if it's troublesome, it's supposed to be happening. And so when you get that mentality that, oh, well, when we're testing drugs, we have to test them one at a time. When you apply that to nutrition, you destroy the value of all the data you collect. If you only study one thing, you really don't learn anything. You really have to look at the entire spectrum of nutrition. So the presence of a drug is like the absence of a nutrient, not the presence of a nutrient. So the entire mentality is dysfunctional.
Is there a way for you to test your like own supplements when you get them? Like, could you ship them to some kind of lab or something like that to get them, you know, individually tested?
It's about $1,000.
Oh, wow. So it's not. Most people aren't going to be able to do that.
Right. I suppose if you found a company that could do that, they could get the cost down to maybe $100 to $250 if they knew what kind of column to use and had it set up and ready to go. They could get the testing down that low. But if you're spending $20 on a supplement, spending $200 to have it tested, it's just not economical.
So what do you recommend instead? Is there like a couple maybe brand names you can recommend, or
no?
What's the other approach?
I don't do that. It's not only do I not maintain current knowledge about all the different manufacturers, but I've seen too many companies change hands and have their quality control devolve in some way.
So is the other approach to that just kind of doing your own due diligence, like you said, maybe calling the supplement companies, figuring out their short runs, how often they produce, where they're getting it from? Is that kind of the only other way to do it?
Sure. Ask for a quality assurance document for different ingredients in the formula and see if they provide it to you. And find out where they get it from and see, if they give you that kind of information, they give you disclosure about it, at least you have some assurance that the company is operating ethically.
Hey man, I got a couple quick reminders I want to share with you. First, the Elite Man podcast is available on all podcasting channels, including iTunes, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Google Play, and directly on the EliteManMagazine.com website. You can subscribe to any or all of these channels to get every episode as soon as they're available, and I highly recommend you do so. Also, our show notes are always up on the EliteManMagazine.com website for you to check out more info on every podcast we have. This includes the summary of each episode, any links for products, recommendations, or resources we mention, and further info on that episode. And finally, if you're not on our Elite Man newsletter yet, join today at elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter. You'll get all of our podcast episodes, articles, videos, and special content not seen or heard on the site or show. Join the newsletter now, elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter.
Steve, you mentioned earlier in the past episode, actually, that there is something, a product you can take while you're drinking to help you avoid hangovers. Could you elaborate further on that?
Yeah, this is based on research that was done in 1975, and I heard about it in the mid to late 70s, where researchers had found a way to massively block aldehyde toxicity. And aldehyde is a class of chemical that's produced from the metabolism of alcohols. And so if you drink ethanol, you get acetaldehyde as a byproduct, and that's about 30 times more toxic than the alcohol itself. Wow. And then the acetaldehyde metabolizes into acetic acid, which drops back down again to remarkably little toxicity. So it turns out that it's this acetaldehyde that determines your next day experience from drinking the from the alcohol. So if you have a good aldehyde dehydrogenase enzyme, generally you can tolerate exposure to alcohol quite gracefully. But if you're of Irish extraction or Asian extraction, American Indian, those populations have a higher than normal incidence of a dysfunctional acetaldehyde enzyme, and the acetaldehyde produces a reaches higher levels and produces more irritation of the central nervous system. Well, these scientists figured out that if you gave these animals acetaldehyde injections and you gave them an LD90 dose of acetaldehyde, in which 9 out of 10 of the animals die, and the one animal that survives wishes it didn't live, and you give at the same time an injection of vitamin C and the amino acid cysteine, none of the animals die.
Wow.
And some of them don't even look like they get sick. It's a phenomenal system. And basically what you're doing is giving the animal glutathione support. It turns out the glutathione is a primary defender against aldehydes. And when you drink alcohol and it converts to aldehyde, it's being mopped up by your glutathione system, which is already potentially compromised for, you know, reasons we discussed in the previous episode. But if you take the amino acid cysteine, which has the same sulfur group that is found in glutathione, and you take vitamin C in higher doses, which is kind of a storage compartment of the glutathione stability, instead of your glutathione being damaged by the acetaldehyde, the cysteine and sulfur is mops it up instead while it's still in your bloodstream. And therefore, you handle aldehyde exposure gracefully. And this works for formaldehyde, which is found in sick buildings and some people are sensitive to. It's also found in glues and adhesives and carpets and particle board and stuff like that that you might have around your house. It works for acetaldehyde, which is, you know, the main metabolite of alcohol, and it also works for other industrial aldehydes that you might find in paints or in adhesives and stuff like that that you might get exposed to.
How much cysteine and how much vitamin C are you taking, or do they take for this?
Well, the alcohol detox formula that Nutrition Dynamics makes, that the formula I put together, basically is only 50 milligrams of cysteine and 50 milligrams of N-acetylcysteine and about 600 milligrams or so, 500 to 600 of vitamin C. Vitamin C is basically put into the capsule to fill it up. It doesn't really matter if it's 500 to 600, 700. It's just there, as much of it as you can put in the pill is actually better than trying to restrict it in any way. And then the formula is you take one capsule before you start drinking, and then you take one capsule after every drink. So if you have one drink, you take two capsules. If you have four drinks, you take five capsules. And so it scales based on how much you're drinking, and it scales for the time frame of what you're exposed. So you're keeping the cysteine and C going into your bloodstream at the same time the alcohol is flowing through your bloodstream.
Very interesting. Does this affect the rate or ability to actually like get drunk too, or is this just kind of like for the after effect?
It's just the after effects. It doesn't stop you from getting drunk, and you know, nobody should drive after taking the alcohol detox formula, or nobody should juggle chainsaws, or
That makes sense, man. I actually had Dr. Mark Gordon on the show too a while back, and he talked about something kind of similar. I don't know if it was the maybe same research or maybe a little different, but there was a formula he recommended that was a liposomal glutathione, he said milk thistle worked well too, like certain types of milk thistle for, again, like the glutathione production.
Yeah, well, that's true. That is an herbal way to approach the issue. But that's a longer term kind of strategy. It tends to work better for people exposed to, for example, sick building syndrome, where you're working in a building and exposed to 8 hours a day of some low level of formaldehyde or acetaldehyde, where you need constant protection. Versus this formula, which is designed for acute exposure. So, you know, you're getting married and your best friends are insisting that you go to Las Vegas for a bachelor party, And, you know, you can't in good form refuse. So you're going to be binging on alcohol for a short period of time, and you know exactly when that's going to be you're going to be exposed. But there's also a secondary issue that can happen with hangovers that happen from a class of impurity that's found in alcoholic beverages, like congeners. So if you're drinking vodka, you're primarily only getting exposed to alcohol. But if you're drinking dark rum, or you're drinking gin, you're drinking wine or beer, you have these secondary products in there that need to be detoxified by your liver. And so there's a whole host of things that you can do, from activated charcoal to kind of absorb them and keep them from away from your body, to taking herbs that strengthen certain enzyme systems to enhance the metabolism of these congeners. And that makes a difference if you're exposed to dirty alcohol.
Mm-hmm. So I guess your recommendation here would be to stick to the vodka. It's probably
well,
easiest to.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm a big fan of wine, and you know, red wine is very rich in polyphenols. Mm-hmm. You know, these have, you know, resveratrol and other compounds in them. So, you know, you've got, I mean, most of our diet and most of our eating and our lifestyle choices have both good and bad effects blended together. And so, you know, part of it is recognizing the good and the bad, and recognizing when something that's bad, that's found in something, is just too much for you, and that you're willing to give up the good stuff, or maybe even just take it out. So if you're sensitive to alcohol, you've got Asian or Irish genes, and you don't handle alcohol gracefully, but you still want your resveratrol, you can take it in a capsule.
Switching gears, I know you talk about this regularly, and I heard you mention it on a couple other shows. What is the, I guess, importance of regulating your body's pH balance? Like, what does this do in your body, and can you kind of explain this to our listeners, like, what's actually going on, like, you know, beneath the sort of surface of your body, like the temperature and everything?
Yeah. Well, we have foods have both acid ash and alkaline ash. And so if you study macrobiotic theory, for example, they'll classify everything according to whether it's, you know, it leaves an acid influence in your body when it's metabolized, or if it leaves an alkaline residue. So something like orange juice or lemon juice that you would think would be acidic because it's tart to your tongue actually has an alkaline ash. And something like fat, which has a neutral, doesn't have a tartness at all, leaves an acid ash. So that's one of the problems in terms of understanding it, is to understand what the effect is at different levels of your body. From a dietary perspective, it's important to realize that the acid and alkaline components of your diet need to also be balanced with respect to your metabolism. And your metabolism, the energy part of your metabolism, generates acid waste, and the healing part of your metabolism generates alkaline waste. And therefore, if your metabolism is low and you have low acid being produced, you have to balance that with a diet that has more acid in it to keep your acid and alkaline balance adjusted properly. And this is a big problem with people who have autoimmune diseases and fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndromes, where they have cold hands and feet and low body temperature, low pulse rate, that a lot of practitioners will put them on an alkalinizing diet of vegan or vegetarian, not realizing that they don't have the metabolic capacity to balance all that alkalinizing food. And they crash and burn, and it's not pretty, and the amount of pain and suffering that people have gone through is immense. So, you know, my approach is to try to understand in advance what people can tolerate, and instead of immediately putting somebody on a highly alkalinizing diet, try to sound out them about whether they've tried something like this before and it's had a bad effect, or whether or not they show other signs of having a low metabolism, like low body temperature, low pulse rate, a tendency towards constipation, a longer than 24-hour circadian rhythm, you know, things like that. I also teach people breath hold time as a study of a carbon dioxide indicator. So when you're burning fuel, whether you're burning carbohydrate fuel or you're burning fat fuel, the end product is either carbon dioxide or lactic acid. And it makes a huge difference in how you feel. If you're burning fuel aerobically, you're producing CO2, and you can get a handle on that by studying your breath hold time. So if you can hold your breath for a very, very long period of time, more than a minute, you typically have low CO2 levels. And if you can hold your breath only for a short period of time, let's say less than 30 seconds, it means your CO2 levels are high because your breathing is triggered by CO2 and not oxygen. So this is, it's easy enough to study if you know what to pay attention to. You can do a systematic metabolic study of yourself by looking at things like body temperature and CO2, and you can study your lactic acid by, for example, looking at how exercise gives you muscle pain. So if you flip from aerobic metabolism, where you're burning fuel all the way to CO2, you rarely get muscle pain. And if you're anaerobically burning your fuel and then they have lactic acid, you always get muscle pain. So it's not that hard to figure these kinds of things out.
That's really interesting, man. Actually, maybe you can actually kind of help me with this answer. Back in high school, I did some wrestling, and I know there's different energy systems going on with this, and I think it kind of directly relates to what you just said. But I was good, and actually now I'm good at, like, say, running long distances. Not really long distances, but say 3 to 5 miles or whatever. I can just pick it up any day and just run it. Maybe even, you know, 10 miles. I could do 10 miles easily. And I'm not, like, bragging about it, but it comes naturally to me where I could just pick it up and run. If I haven't run 10 miles in a few years, I can just run it today. But on the other hand, when I used to wrestle in high school, I was good at wrestling for, like, the first round, and then I would just completely, like, gas out. And it was very weird, too, because I was training hard. I was, you know, doing all the exercise. One of the hardest working wrestlers there as far as work ethic went. But I always found that I was gassing out within, like, 2 minutes of the wrestling. And I always kind of wanted to know what was going on there. And I think, you know, it has to do with this kind of thing with, like, the aerobic metabolism. You know, the levels or whatever weren't quite there for me.
Well, yeah, so long-distance running would draw upon your energy reserves slowly over an extended period of time, and wrestling is peak performance. It's like sprinting. You do much more energy for a short period of time, and it's not about your stamina, even though, you know, you might consider, you know, a three-minute, you know, wrestling match to be stamina. Compared to long-distance running, it's not really that much stamina. So it could have been an issue of glycogen reserves in your muscle that you exhausted. And, you know, my experience with wrestling was exactly the opposite. I was really good for the long run and not very good for short stuff.
Yeah, so it could be a number of things. But you know what was funny, too, is I'm consider myself a sprinter. I was one of the fastest kids in my high school, and I'm really quick, you know, short distance as well, which kind of didn't make sense to me either. I thought I was more of an explosive kind of athlete, but I think now I am more of a long distance kind of an athlete. But I don't know. I couldn't really figure out where the issue was there.
Well, you can do a lot of that investigation by doing things like carb loading and looking to see what that does for your short-term and long-term performance versus, for example, fat loading.
Mm-hmm. Which would do what?
Oh, that's mainly long distance.
Fat loading is for long distance?
Yeah. So you burn through your carbs relatively fat. And when people are doing marathons and they talk about hitting the wall, that's basically where you burn through your carb reserves, and you now are switching over to fat-burning metabolism. And so, you know, there are ways to exercise that. And dietary periodic fasting, episodic fasting, partial fasting, intermittent fasting, these are ways to exercise that switch from burning carbs to burning fat and go back and forth. And eventually, if you do that enough, it becomes transparent. If you accidentally miss a meal, you just don't even notice it. And, you know, in terms of your long distance running, when you hit the wall, you might not even notice it because your body is agile at switching from burning carbs to burning fat.
But it definitely, you know, is really interesting and something I think I'd like to further investigate. But It's definitely a really cool subject, man, and I love that you know, you're so familiar with it.
Anybody who works out has an automatic advantage in a lot of ways. One, exercise has a variety of anti-aging effects, and it stimulates free radicals that stimulate antioxidant defenses. But from a biohacking point of view, it gives you a way of studying your body in a performance environment where it's measured. You go to the gym, you have known weights and known reps and this kind of stuff. If you do bicycling or running, you have known routes and you have a stopwatch, you can time yourself. It's a controlled environment. Even if you do something different fairly frequently, you still have things that you can compare to each other.
I love to. I was a big journaler as far as like weightlifting goes, to kind of keep track of things and, you know, keep track of the weight you're doing, the reps, the sets, how much is going up, how much, you know, it hasn't gone up, and just kind of testing and figuring out what you can do to improve yourself. Also keeping track of like your body weight, your fat percentage, your body fat percentage, all those things to see what's working. And then, of course, your diet, which goes right along with that. From what I understand, you are a fan of the ketogenic diet. Is that right?
Well, I'm a fan of intermittent fasting and partial fasting. And that you, to some extent, have to be paleo to do that. So there are times when I think that eating huge amounts of carbs is good for you, and other times when, most of the time, when restricting carbs is good for you. But I'm saying that doing fat restriction and doing protein restriction have their role as well to play in anybody who wants to live to be over 100 years of age.
And why is that?
Well, when I've looked at people through this lens of fat burning, all the graceful agers burn fat gracefully. They're just good at it. And people who don't burn fat don't live to be, you know, those old ages. They develop diseases and diabetes and aches and pains and they get more serious infections when the flu season comes around. But people who burn fat age more gracefully, and so that's that. In looking at, you know, what ancient man used to do, I think that fits exactly. Back in those days, we would fast on a regular basis. Our food supply wasn't Safeway. It was, you had to find it. And there were times when you'd feast, and there are times when you'd fast. You know, food was plentiful and food was lacking. And every time that food was lacking, your system learned how to conserve food, how to switch from carb burning to fat burning, how to ration your calories, whatever it was that was the lesson. Every time that happened, it helped make you stronger. We don't do that anymore. We overeat all the time. We have carbohydrates on the shelf every day of the year. So if we're going to mimic what our distant ancestors did in order to accommodate and adopt a wild style of diet, we have to do without food periodically.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, working out, like stressing your body or whatever, you actually become stronger because you're working out. It's kind of the same principle here, like where you're stressing just putting stress on your diet, where it's not like you're overeating all the time and your body becomes complacent or comfortable, but it kind of keeps it on edge, right?
Yep, that's exactly right. And looking at metabolic systems as equally deserving of exercise as your muscles and your bones and your ligaments and your tendons and your lung capacity and your heart capacity.
So how often do you recommend fasting? How often do you do it?
Two or three times a month for carb restriction. Once every 2 months for protein restriction. I really don't do fat restriction much, but, you know, I might run into a good reason for doing that. So it's when you do protein restriction, it stimulates a process called autophagy, which is, the words mean self-digestion. And that process where your body goes in and starts breaking down your muscles and breaking down your bones and dissolving your mitochondria and all – it serves a constructive purpose of cleaning out the debris. So the stuff you break down doesn't end up getting replaced if it's not important. And if it is important, it gets replaced. And so even though you might lose a little bit of bone mass and a little bit of muscle mass in terms of doing a protein fast, it rapidly gets replaced. Whereas any senescent mitochondria you have or scar tissue that you have that gets burned doesn't get replaced. So it serves this kind of, you know, tuning your body by discarding dysfunctional parts of it. And given that what we now know about mitochondria and mitochondrial aging and mitochondrial senescence in its role in aging, anything that you can do to keep your mitochondria tuned up is probably going to help you live longer and help you live better.
Cool. I like that, man. What are your thoughts on antioxidants and inflammation in the body?
Well, antioxidants was one of the things that I made probably the biggest mistake of my career in buying into the idea that antioxidants were a good thing. And it's not that they're a bad thing. It's that the antioxidant defense system is a lot more complicated than we thought. And if you take huge quantities of antioxidants exogenously, you downregulate your endogenous antioxidant system. So you've got SOD and catalase and glutathione peroxidase in your body that your body is making in response to free radical challenges, which if you exercise gives you greater levels of those protective enzymes, and that your antioxidants that you take in are designed to complement those instead of overruling them. And that it's more important to have broad spectrum antioxidant capacity than having really high levels of any one or a few antioxidants. Mm-hmm. So I caution people about taking huge doses of any antioxidant. The only antioxidant I support it would be vitamin C. And even for that one, I caution people against taking high doses intermittently. In other words, if you're taking, 2 to 4 grams a day and you skip a day, it's probably not going to do much for you, negatively. But if you're taking, 20 grams a day and you go on vacation and spend a week in Mexico and don't take any, I think you're very likely to get sick, and sick to a very serious degree. The vitamin C rebound effect happens within 24 to 48 hours, and your body vitamin C level can go to scurvy levels in about 24 hours. And that's very, very tough on people and has a very negative effect on your immune system.
That's really interesting, man. I didn't really realize that there was a kind of a rebound effect with antioxidants and even vitamin C.
Well, vitamin C is the specific one because most mammals make between 10 and 20 grams a day an animal of our body weight. And so we have that innate capability of handling those kinds of doses. But in a normal life, we are misers, vitamin C misers. We're stingy about our vitamin C, and we ration it out carefully, very, very carefully. So when we suddenly start taking 2 to 4 grams of vitamin C, instead of getting 1% of the vitamin that a cat or a dog would get, we're now getting 10%. And so our body starts to spend it lavishly. And if we take, 20 grams a day, we're now taking this 100% of what a cat or a dog would get, and our body starts acting like a drunken sailor on liberty, spending the vitamin C. So if you stop suddenly, it takes a while for your body to figure out that, there's not that much vitamin C around again. And so your body spends it into a state of extreme deficiency. And that's rebound scurvy, and that's pretty unique to vitamin C. We're a rare mammal in that we don't make vitamin C. And so that's a rule that is unique to vitamin C in humans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very interesting stuff, man. Just a few more questions, Steve, and then we're going to wrap things up, man. It's been, you know, a pleasure to have you back on again. Really do appreciate it. Curious, man, what are your thoughts on oxygen therapy, like oxygenizing the blood and kind of the effects that can have on your health?
It's a great way to treat people and to find out certain things about them. Oxygen therapies are like exercise, build strength and stamina in people. Oxygen can be a limiting factor in people's metabolism. You know, when we burn fuel, we talk about that's really oxygen that's combining with our food in order to generate either lactic acid or CO2. And hydrogen peroxide is very efficiently dismutated by the body. So when you do use hydrogen peroxide therapeutically, you're very efficiently stimulating a particular set of enzymes that are designed to detoxify it. And that would be catalase and glutathione peroxidase. But interestingly enough, ozone is most fascinating to me because we really don't know.
I'm so glad you brought that up. Because I was going to ask you about that.
It's so amazing in terms of its potential use in dealing with viral diseases and dealing with joint reconstructions. A lot of people with bad knees can do ozone injections into the knee and completely avoid the need for a knee replacement.
Yeah, I actually I've interviewed some people as well, and ozone has how do I put this, periodically or not periodically, but testimonially, is that a word?
Yeah, sure. Make it up. It makes sense. I understood exactly what you're referring to.
Okay, so a lot of these doctors out there actually are using ozone to help with cancer treatments and reversing cancer. And that's why I wanted to bring it up to you and kind of what you thought on that, because a lot of them say, and I guess the kind of theory behind it is that diseases, cancer, you know, viral, bacterial, any disease really can't thrive in an oxygenated environment. And so ozone is like one of the best ways to get that into the body.
It's not true of fungi. Fungi do live in an oxygen environment just fine, but it's true of bacteria and viruses. Very few bacteria and viruses like oxygen. And certainly cancer tends to be anaerobic. So oxygen can be used for that. But the interesting thing about ozone is that the body doesn't have an efficient way of dismutating it. So unlike hydrogen peroxide, where you put it into your body and your body reacts to it and this enzyme gets produced to specifically destroy it, ozone, there is no such system. And so the ozone can diffuse into your deeper tissues before it gets reacts with something to be dismutated. And so you actually get deep tissue response to ozone that you don't get from hydrogen peroxide or to a lesser extent, maybe also hyperbaric oxygen. So it's I think, you know, fascinating that certain healing responses seem to be stimulated by ozone in a way that is not mimicked by any of the other oxidizing agents.
Yeah, there's this machine I heard about in, I think it was Ty Ballinger I was talking to that mentioned it, or one of the other guys, I forget exactly who it was, but basically they're taking in different countries, there's a couple doctors or whatever, maybe Germany or Mexico, a couple places like that, where they have...
Germany and Cuba.
Cuba, okay. yeah, probably right. Yeah, actually, you're right. It is Cuba, because they're actually given Castro, for as bad as a person he was, they were giving him some credit for some of the advances he had in health or whatever. But I mean, you know, it's a different topic, but you're right, it was Cuba. But they're taking cancer patients' blood and seeping it through this machine, this ozone machine, O3, is that right?
Yes.
Taking it, putting it through,
and
this
then
machine,
they reinfuse it.
Yeah, reinfuse it back in, and it basically kills out all of the cancer within the blood. And you do it multiple times, not just like one time and then you're good. They do it over a course of, like, say, a few weeks or months, but they're using that to, like, kill out the cancer or whatever diseases they're trying to fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can be quite useful, and it's a perfect example of the bias in the educational systems for doctors in the United States that when you mention ozone to an average doctor, they've never heard about it before and can't believe that it could possibly do what it does.
How effective, from I guess what you've read, is using ozone?
Well, for joint reconstruction, I think it's pretty much unparalleled. Even prolotherapy therapy doesn't meet up with it, doesn't match it. And even collagen therapy, which is, you know, the foundation of ligaments and tendons and bones, only makes ozone better. It doesn't come close to matching it. It's you know, collagen therapy is more about maintaining your knees and ligaments and tendons against wear than it is actually rebuilding the tissues. But I've actually had my own clients do ozone therapy, and if I didn't have an expectation from having her doctors talk about it, I would have been flabbergasted.
Wow. What about your thoughts on like those ozone generators, like the portable home use ones? Are those any good, or are those just kind of crap?
Well, I wouldn't suggest anybody do ozone generation at home unless they're willing to get an oxygen tank. The problem with ozone generators using air is that it not only generates ozone, but generates nitric oxides. NO2 is very deleterious to human health. So ozone generators that use air, I think that's a mistake to do that. But ozone generators, small-scale ones that use an oxygen tank, they can be done at home. And the experience of the doctors in Cuba, where they're severely cost-constrained, is that regular use of anal insufflation, where you basically squirt the ozone up your butt and hold it as long as you can, that's a very, very good practice that avoids the need for doing this, you know, needle stick and the taking the blood out and being careful to anticoagulate it before you put it back in again. All that medical complication is avoided.
Yeah, I was reading a book that was talking about that. What is it called?
Insufflation.
Insufflation. Okay, yeah.
So it's basically holding on to either a liquid or a gas, and insufflation usually means a gas. And so, you know, there's a certain amount of discomfort, and, you know, there's always the, you know, the issue of trying to operate in a shower stall in a bathroom with ozone, because you don't want to breathe the ozone. So you have to have a very, very carefully worked out ventilation system so that, you know, you have fresh air flowing into the bathroom so that when you release any ozone, you don't breathe it.
You could get really sick from it. And the book, by the way, was Flood Your Body with Oxygen, Ed McCabe. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yep.
Yeah, really interesting. But, I mean, it's, you know, so many different things in there, and it's like 20 years old, but it's like there's still great – I don't know how old it is. It's probably like 20 years old, but there's still, you know, so many great information in there. It's just kind of really fascinating.
Yeah, and there are some practitioners around who are using ozone. It does take some work to find them because, you know, it's still a frowned upon technology in the United States by both the FDA's perspective and by medical regulators. But it's actually quite safe when it's done properly. And I've had it to wonderful effect.
Steve, just kind of wrapping things up, man, is there any last takeaway message you'd like to leave our audience? I know we've done two full interviews now and, you know, talked about everything under the sun, from Alzheimer's to Parkinson's to biohacking, smart drugs, supplements, just living healthier in general, like what you can do. What is your sort of last takeaway message before we wrap things up, you know, for the last time here? Maybe we can get you back on the show again down the road, but what would you like to leave our Elite Man audience, man, and then also a place that they can check out more about you?
Well, I think that finding me on the internet is as simple as typing my name into a search engine. But, you know, I have contact information on Project Wellbeing, so if you want to call me and talk to me about a consultation, even just finding out whether or not you want to do a consultation, that's all doable. I'm all over the internet. But, you know, fundamentally, I think the thing that a lot of people don't really realize is how phenomenal our self-healing mechanisms are. I mean, our bodies have an amazing capacity for healing and regeneration and recovery. And almost no matter how diseased you are, how disabled you are, how long you've been dealing with autoimmune disease, if you can alter certain fundamental causes of it, your body can potentially recover. And I've, for Down syndrome, for example, preventing mental retardation, I think you can block 85% of that if you start at birth. Lots of people with MS and other autoimmune diseases have completely reversed their condition. Even medical doctors have done this. So don't get psychologically stuck in believing that a disease is something that you have to live with. Look into what you can do to figure it out. And I think you'll be glad if you do that, and you know, that you'll be glad that you can get good results.
Thanks again, Steve, for coming on the show and doing both episodes. Had a great time with you, man, and learned so much personally. And I know our guys are going to absolutely love this. So take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
Good. Hopefully we'll catch up again. Take care.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.